Blog Talk Radio.
Special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
We had the thing there about
Josecito Lopez being the Riverside Rocky. It looked like he pretty much was a huge underdog coming into this fight at the Barclays Center. What we had there is you had Keith Thurman, trying to get in there, trying to see where he's at in this particular point of his career, after the extended layoff, going up against Josecito Lopez, who, had his good amount of share of losses. I think he, came in there with a record of 36 wins and 7 losses. So he looked like he, some people thought that maybe Josecito Lopez would be a little bit, rugged and rough there, but, eventually would, fall to Keith Thurman in this particular fight. Now, in the first couple of rounds there, you saw Keith Thurman, using what he usually does in his fights. He usually fights in range, uses the jab, tries to keep his opponent away with the jab, and then, tries to follow up afterwards, after that jab to get to Josecito Lopez, while Josecito Lopez was pretty much zeroed in on trying to get at Keith Thurman, almost, to a level to the point where you had that Keith Thurman versus Sean Porter fight, where Sean Porter kind of like was having a right come forward first style, trying to tie Keith Thurman up while Keith Thurman was backing away and going to the ropes. But, here with Josecito Lopez, you had somebody there who, was, kind of there at, 5'9", a little bit taller than, Sean Porter. So, there at the, also had the thing there with the reach as well. So, there were times where you kind of like seen that, that Josecito Lopez was, a little bit of a slower fighter. And Keith Thurman caught him a couple of times in the first round. Looked a little bit sharp there in that first round, and then, followed that up with what happened there in the second round, as Keith Thurman was able to, score a knockdown there in round two. And with that knockdown in round two, we kind of like had, the momentum in there and, kind of like got a little bit of confidence in him as he kind of like followed through with his aggression a little bit. But it seemed like he was a tad over-aggressive in those next couple of rounds. He pretty much, let Lopez kind of like shake that off a little bit and, get into the fight and get his bearings back. Pretty much Lopez kind of like made that adjustment. He tried to get to Thurman's body. Of course, we know about, the whole talk about Thurman and maybe him being a little bit soft in the middle. So, Lopez tried to attack that there a little bit. So he kind of like get into that there pretty much in the third. But then the fourth round, you kind of like saw the action pick up there in the fourth round. Lopez was buzzing up Thurman a little bit. Kind of like saw a few openings there from Keith Thurman, and he tried to take advantage of those there in the fourth round. So that's the thing we had going on there a little bit. I'm going to see if I could get a caller in here live while I'm going through these first four rounds that we had. I think I got them on live now. Area code 205, you're live now with the Boxing Source Radio Show.
Hey, what's going on, James? This is Mike Grady calling out of Atlanta. How you doing, man?
Yeah, what's up? What's up? See that things are about to pick up over there in that city here in the next couple of days. So, traffic around Atlanta has already had that MO of being bad. Now it might get a little bit worse here over the course of the week.
Yeah, I think I'm going to definitely be visiting my son that weekend, and I probably won't come in until probably maybe even Monday, just to be real, just to avoid it. So that's something to think about.
Yeah, true that, true that. Going through the first few rounds here with that title fight between Keith Thurman and Jose Zito Lopez, where, you know, Keith Thurman scored that knockdown in round two to put Lopez down to the canvas. But Lopez was able to, you know, get back into it pretty much by the fourth round, and action started to pick up in the fourth round right there with Lopez going to the body a little bit with the fourth, but Thurman kind of like responded with a few power punches. But then like in the fifth and sixth, you know, that's where Lopez kind of like tried to get himself back into the fight. There before that seventh round where, you know, pretty much a lot of people were talking about that seventh round as a very good round and kind of like made the fight, you know, better than many people expected there with that seventh round. So I don't know what to really kind of like gauge, you know, completely out of that fight as, you know, Thurman got out of there with the decision, with the majority decision. And, you know, Thurman looked like he was a more, you know, active person in that fight. But, you know, he kind of like got caught a few times. What did you assess from this fight here from Keith Thurman and Jose Zito Lopez?
Yeah, I didn't feel like writing a post-fight reaction to it because it was quite a few things that I saw, but at the end of the day, I'm going to say what I got to say, but I'll start off by saying I think it's too early to judge and say, you know, where Keith Thurman is at or where he isn't at because, you know, coming off a two-year layoff and Jose Zito Lopez isn't a slouch, you know, yeah, he has gotten stopped by the best guys. But I will say, in me watching Jose Zito Lopez, I feel like Jose Zito Lopez has gotten better over the years. I mean, I don't think he has faced this is his first top guy in a while. But from my last few fights seeing him, it's like he has gotten better. And then, you know, it's something to speak on the guys who come from Big Bear and train up in the mountains. Like, to me, is a winning formula, you know, at least in terms of being able to take punishment and keep it coming, you know, because I know that is the main reason why Tyson Fury, you know, was so resilient in being able to take the punches outside of Deontay Wilder having his worst performance. But, you know, his wind and just ability to recover, you know, after taking those punches was so enhanced by probably the altitude and all that good stuff. Like, the benefits of training in high altitude, you can see them. They're plentiful. But in terms of the fight, I mean, as you said, before round seven, Keith Thurman was, for the most part, controlling the action and winning the fight. I'm not going to say necessarily easy. It was competitive. Keith Thurman rounds, competitive one-sided rounds. And so, you know, Jose Zito Lopez definitely was game and he wanted to win. And the reason why, like, Thurman didn't hurt him is because Thurman was too much on his bike. He wasn't sitting down on any of his punches. And, you know, Thurman does a great job of walking people into punches. And so, you know, he has the whole thing where he'll move in one direction, get you to move, and then he'll switch directions and walk you into that punch. And so he was doing that all night. And, you know, he was pretty much on his bike. And you're not going to hurt anyone if you continue moving. And we've seen that with what's the guy who Jaime Munguia knocked out? We've seen that with him. He's always down his bike. We've seen that. What's his name?
When Munguia fought Saddam Ali.
Yeah, Saddam Ali stay on his bike. That's why he don't really hurt people. And the fight where he stopped moving on like that, and he stopped staying on his bike, he hurt somebody and he stopped someone. We see that with Amir Khan. Amir Khan stay on his bike. That's why you can say Amir Khan is not a power puncher. We see that with Tim Bradley, when Tim Bradley used to move all the time before he got, like, you know, quotation marks, older. I mean, Thurman didn't hurt him past the second round because he was just on his bike too much and he didn't set on the punches.
It looked like he tried to bait Jose Cito Lopez, especially, you know, early in the fight. You know, maybe that's, you know, why he got he caught Lopez there in the second round. But he didn't necessarily, like, you know, follow through as far as, like, mixing up his attacks against Jose Cito Lopez, and was, you know, kind of like content a lot of times, you know, sitting off his back foot, you know, throwing his punch.
But again, I don't think we can say stuff too concrete about Thurman's win, because it looked like, number one, he had a hand injury, and number two, I mean, this is a 2-year layoff, and he's fighting somebody who's been, quotation marks, active from a 2-year layoff, you know, and a pressure fighter at that. I think we need to see him fight another fight or two before we can say how he gonna do. But, I mean, truth be told, I could extrapolate and say he's gonna have trouble with Errol Spence. It just depends on how his power translates, because if it's like it was yesterday, he's gonna be in a world of trouble. If he don't have enough and he's sitting down on his stuff to hurt Errol Spence, then I think it's gonna be a longer day. Something that goes in his favor. Errol Spence don't move his head, so that's going to be an interesting fight, because he's going to be able to touch Errol Spence and sit there and swing really big and then move. You know what I'm saying? He can swing, sit, boom, move, and then move. And then, you know, yeah, he might get hit with a body shot or two, but he'll at least be able to touch Errol Spence. And the deciding factor would be if he hurt him or not. Terrence Crawford, I mean, that'd be interesting. I think we're in a good position that we got all these guys that we can flip a coin and say whether or not we don't know somebody will win or not. I think that's the best position to be in.
Well, yeah, I think this performance kind of, like, lured a lot of the top contenders there in the welterweight division to go after Keith Thurman. You know, Terrence Crawford had his immediate reaction on Twitter was saying, like, you know, ooh-wee, it's like, man, this might be barbecue chicken if I go up against him, or, you know, somebody like Sean Porter out there that, you know, has his fight later on down the line on March 9th, and then also Errol Spence, who has his fight on March 16th. But, you know, you also, you know, have the regular champion at the WBA, Manny Pacquiao, that Keith Thurman talked about immediately after the fight, that, you know, he may want to, you know, fight Manny Pacquiao, and that, you know, would be a very interesting matchup. And a lot of, you know, people that watch this fight said that, hey, Manny Pacquiao, even at his, you know, age of 40, you know, probably could give Keith Thurman a good run. And, you know, Thurman was talking a lot in reference to a potential fight with Manny Pacquiao, but he does have to, you know, get himself more into, you know, being in ring shape and being sharp there in the ring before he could go up against those top guys there in the welterweight division. So we may see him in one other fight before he goes up against one of those top guys. You might, you know, possibly see him, you know, sometime in the summer months first before you have that kind of like that high profile fight with the, you know, with the likes of a Sean Porter or Danny Garcia or Manny Pacquiao or, you know, a Errol Spence out there.
Yeah, Pacquiao would definitely give anybody problems. I think he a tough out for anybody. Not named Floyd Mayweather. Not named old Floyd Mayweather. I don't know how Floyd Mayweather gonna look if he does come back, but you know, he a tough out for anybody not named Floyd Mayweather for retirement.
Gotcha. Now we got another caller in. Area code 646 is live with the Boxing Source Radio Show. What's good?
JR, the first thing that I want to be done before I say anything is to get that piece of crap, Gerald Washington, out of the ring. Don't just get him out of the ring. Get him out of boxing. Because last night proved, son, without a shadow of a doubt, that he ain't got what it takes anymore. He sit there and he dump his Wilder fight. He talk about PBC, he say his friends, he's talking about songs, he's talking about John 316, well, Konaki 316, because I just ripped your ass. So all he got to do is buy himself a cheap bottle of steroids, some of that courage that he had three fights ago. Because as the new Polish babyface assassin, he is putting every heavyweight on notice. And I don't give a damn what they are. They're all on the list. And I'm fixing to start running through all of them. I'm pissed off. As far as Deontay Wilder and his little WBC championship is concerned, son, I don't give a damn if it's Wilder. I don't give a damn if it's Fury. Adam Konacki's time has come. And when he does get that shot, you are looking at the next world heavyweight champion. And that's the bottom line, because Adam Konacki said so.
Well, wait a second now, Matt. Let's slow down here. Let's slow down. We might be getting ahead of ourselves. Let's make sure we check all the facts here. Konacki looked good. We cannot take that away from him. You're right. He's a very skillful person. And until he faces somebody that is in that tier, we can't really say how he's going to do. Like Gerald Washington.
Line him up.
Gerald Washington, who told him to come to this fight and fight Konacki like that? Who told him to fight like that? Why would he fight like this? Why would he not try to use his height and box and, you know, hell, make
line
it a longer up. Fight? It was a terrible game plan. End of story.
Line him up. He knocked him down. That's it. Line him up. He knocked him down.
Apparently, you know, we're talking about, in this case, the co-feature bout that took place. Heavyweight bout, Adam Konacki came in there undefeated, going up against Gerald Washington, who had two losses, one to Deontay Wilder and another to Jarrell Miller. And Adam Konacki pretty much came with his regular come-forward style against Gerald Washington, who was there, that was a much taller fighter, had the range, but never really used how to use his range at any point. In his career, for the most part. And so he didn't know what to do against someone that, you know, comes forward and keeps throwing punches and just throws punches and bunches. That's what Adam Konacki does. Konacki was able to, you know, take a few punches there with Gerald Washington, but they weren't enough to Adam Konacki at a distance. And so he just kept going forward, and he seriously hurt Gerald Washington there in the first round, and then in the second round, caught him real good, hurt him bad, and put him down to the canvas. And Gerald Washington could barely get up from that knockdown, and then you know, the rest will be allowed for about a few months before Kyle Maxey came in there and basically finished them off. So he's undefeated, and you know, kind of like put him in the hat for like a potential heavyweight title contender. And make that later on this
show. Like I said, JR, line him up. He'll knock him down. Gerald Washington took one look at that Dusty Rhodes body that Adam Konecki walks around with, and he thought that he was just going to come in there and blow him out of there. But don't let the body fool you. Don't let the baby face fool you. This man, Adam Konecki, has dynamite in both his hands. He lets his hands go. This man threw 100 punches in the first round. A heavyweight throwing 100 punches, and not just pity-pat punches like his fat friend Jarrell Miller. No, no, no. He was throwing 100 punches with bad intention. It's one of the rarest combinations in boxing. You had your Paul Williams, who used to throw a bunch of punches. You had your Nico Macias that throws 200 punches around. You have these guys that can throw a lot of punches, but they can't sit down on them and bring the pain. Adam Konecki brings the rain, and he brings the pain. And you saw him signal towards that chicken leg coward sitting in the audience, Deontay Wilder. You saw him signaling towards him. He's coming for that strap.
Speaking of punches, let me say something real quick, James. Speaking of punches, Konecki got touched by Gerald Washington. And if he gets touched by the upper echelon in this division, him sticking around ain't a realistic. Like, I'm sure you saw that, right? He got touched. And if he gets touched against the better people.
Power? Can they withstand the onslaught? Can they withstand the better that's coming their way?
I think Jared Washington got off first. And then once he was like, oh, shit, I can't hurt this guy. He knew it was kind of probably like over before it began. But let Joshua or Gerald Miller or Wilder or Ortiz touch this guy, and they hit him with three punches flush in the beginning. In the beginning, it's gonna be night night.
I guess night we're quill gonna have time, to see, aren't we? Like I said, line them up. He's number 5 in the IBF rankings. He's number 8 in the WBC rankings. By the end of the year, he's going to have his name in title contention, and these guys are not going to rush to fight him. They're just not going to rush to fight him.
Well, I mean, I did say that, you know, he is the potential opponent there for Deontay Wilder, and you know, in 2016, January 2016, we did see Deontay Wilder go up against Archer Spilker, and in that particular fight there at the Barclays Center, there were a good amount of fans that were supporting Archer Spilker in that fight, and I feel that, you know, the support for Adam Konecki has, you know, greatly surpassed what Archer Spilker had. And so, you know, there, what you're going to see is if they set up a fight between Deontay Wilder and Adam Konecki, they put it at the Barclays Center. That's easy money. I mean, that is definitely easy money. I think that, you know, they kind of like built up, you know, the profile for Adam Konecki there for him to be a, you know, greatly supported fighter in a fighter that is backed by a lot of fans, whether it's, you know, in New York or Chicago, New Jersey, or, you know, anywhere there within the Northeast. So if you see in the near future, if they have this fight between Deontay Wilder and Adam Konecki for the WBC title, then you're going to see it there in the Barclays Center, and it's going to have a very, very big following there as far as, like, being there at the if it happens. For me, I'm not sure that, you know, Kamaki would be, you know, very successful against Deontay Wilder, but as long as it lasts, it's going to be a very tough fight for Deontay Wilder.
Listen, Konaki could beat any of the top guys just with his style and with the toughness that he shows. He likes to get hit. He wants you to hit him so he could hit you back, so you could know that he's not going to take no step backwards. He's coming for you. It don't matter what you throw at him. He's coming right at you. That's just the way he is. That's his style. That's always been his style. That's why I've been trying to tell people for the better part of a year now that Konaki is coming. He's already a top 10 heavyweight. Just line him up and let's see what happens. Just line them up. That's all.
Now, I did bring up this question about Adam Konaki last night, right after the fight. And, you know, I did say that, you know, potentially, I mean, he's top 10 fighter and say up, but I brought up potential and one of them was Luis Ortiz. They fought each other, who would come out as the winner there. And you said that Luis Ortiz may be a little bit more trouble for him in comparison to another potential opponent, which would be Dominic Brazil. Now, you know, Dominic Brazil, you know, has that, you know, late of being the WBC mandatory currently. And while, you know, we're waiting on the official word of the rematch of Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury, you got to have, you know, Dominic Brazil pretty much in a fight somehow, you know, somewhere. They're not going to – I don't think that they should put him on the shelf like they did in pretty much for most of 2018, as, you know, he didn't fight until – December of 2018, with his previous fight being November 4th, 2017. So they got to, you know, put him into a position where he's a little bit more active, you know, up there in the before getting that potential title shot for the WBC championship.
Well, I think Dominic Brazil, I think what the WBC is going to do is they're going to create an interim title for Dominic Brazil to fight someone while they sort out the heavyweight situation. Because if you think about it, you have the rematch with Wilder and Fury, and then I think after that, you're going to have the WBC champ fight Anthony Joshua, whoever comes out of that matchup. So I think the WBC mandatory is going to be unavailable for probably the rest of the year still. Because the WBC, say what you want. I know you like to rag on them, JR. Oh, when they're going to call the mandatory. I don't give a damn about mandatories. I care about seeing the best and the biggest fights. And one thing the WBC does, they're always amenable to the biggest fights happening, whether or not they have to force it or whether or not they have to skirt their own rules just to make sure the big fights happen. So what's going to happen is they're going to create an interim title. Dominic Brazil is going to fight for it, maybe against Dillian White, maybe against Adam Konaki if Dillian White decides to fight Joshua instead. And that's what's going to happen.
Well, I mean, the WBC pretty much does what they, you know, do regardless of who holds the belt. I'm not sure about, you know, them talking about the putting the biggest fights together because they don't necessarily stay consistent with that throughout the whole, you know, division by division. So, you know, whether it's like heavyweight, light heavyweight, cruiserweight, welterweight, they kind of like set up fights to, you know, either see what they can get out of them or whatever that current title holder wants out of it. So, I mean.
Come on, JR. You can't really say that because they did try to set up Stevenson versus Kovalev. They tried to set up Stevenson versus Kovalev, but Kovalev pulled out of the first bid.
But they
tried to set up Triple G versus Canelo, Come on now. You got to give the WWE credit when credit is due, man. Do try to make the biggest fight that the fans want to see. It's not their fault whether or not a fighter goes through with what they're ruling. They're trying to make the biggest fight. How long have they been trying to make Leo versus Russell?
Yeah, but they kind of bent the rules a little bit with the Golovkin-Canelo thing because they had Golovkin fight a guy that actually came down from super middleweight to fight for the number one spot in the WBC rankings while Gennady Golovkin held two world titles, which you really should not be able to do in any case. And we've never seen it happen in boxing. At least I haven't seen it.
Because they wanted to watch the big fight. Listen, I don't agree with you. I mean, I don't disagree with you. They don't always follow their rules, but they do it in the name of getting the big fight. Now, I'm not saying that they're like Mother Teresa and they're doing it for the betterment of the fans. Obviously, they're doing it because the bigger the fight, the bigger the money, the bigger the sanctioning fee. But the fact of the matter is, I would rather them than what the IBF does. The IBF is going to force Josh Warrington to fight Kid Galahad or vacate his title instead of having a unification bout with Oscar Valdez. Like, would you rather see these mandatories that mean nothing, or would you rather see?
Well, I mean, a lot of people want the best fight the best, but sometimes the people that hold the titles don't want to do that. So that's a whole nother story. Now, we also got, like, another caller in here, area code 813. Live on the Boxing Source Radio Show. What's going on with you?
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Trell coming from Tampa. And I'm a bit late on what you're talking about, but I know you mentioned the WBC number one ranking, stuff like that. And your 646, your boy, Lawanaki, looking good. He looks like the freaking Michelin man, but other than that, he looks good. And he is heavy making. I mean, really, it's almost amazing because, like I said, seriously, the dude looks like the Michelin man, no muscle tone whatsoever, but we all know that, as Gerald Washington demonstrated, you can have all the muscle tone you want in the world, but if you can't fight, it don't mean nothing. You know what I'm saying? So, but it's a wonder what the WBC is going to do, like you guys are kind of talking about. Dillian White has been the number one contender for some time now, and yet he ain't, there's no Deontay Wilder fight for him in sight. And we all know that whatever's going to happen, Wilder's going to be locked in to fight Fury again. I think the WBC already mandated that. So I wouldn't be surprised in the future if we see some kind of WBC match with Glowinaki versus Dillian White for some kind of bullcrap interim title or something like that. So and we know over the years the fans have been made up their own rules when it tends to benefit them. And we do know at times they do want to make the best fights, but I would not doubt it to see some kind of like interim title between Glow and Nachi, Dillian White, or someone of that order. But it's a business, and we'll see what happens. But Glow and Nachi is definitely making some noise with his performance from yesterday. Good for him.
Yeah, man. The thing with Kanaki, man, is that he's a very, very active fighter there in the ring. But, you know, like I was saying there earlier, if he goes up against somebody that's a, you know, fairly good counterpuncher, I mean, he could leave himself open to a lot of big shots. So it's a matter of, you know, if he's able to take those big shots or not. That's my thing about it. So, you know, with him, whether he gets that, you know, opportunity for, you know, world title shot or, you know, going up against the likes of maybe a Luis Ortiz or Dominic Brazil, we'll be able to see where he's at in this particular point of his professional career. Now, you know, like, you know, as I said, he kind of like put Kalnacki there in the top 10. There would be something of interest to see where he would be at this particular point going up against those other guys that are currently in the top 10 there in the heavyweight division to see if he's, you know, able to get those wins against those opponents before eventually stepping. stepping up for a title shot. For those that are listening live, you could call in, get in on the Boxing Talk, 347-237-5539. You also, you know, did have a vacant IBO World Featherweight title fight that was taking place in there at the Barclays Center. It also was for like a top spot for the WBC rankings at featherweight. It was Claudio Moreira going up against Tugso Nyambar, where Nyambar pretty much got the unanimous decision win to stay undefeated there to eventually have a spot to face the WBC featherweight champion. And that WBC featherweight champion is Gary Russell Jr., who was in attendance at the Barclays Center, mainly to watch his brother, Gary Antoine Russell, fight in the preliminary card that was there at the Barclays Center. But, you know, he had a little bit of support there for Nyambar in this particular fight that he had against Claudio Moreira, where he was a little bit more aggressive than Moreira. Moreira looked a lot sloppier in this particular matchup. He, you know, kind of almost like kind of had some rough tactics there. He had a point taken away in round 10. You've seen a couple of instances where he punched behind the head and almost like got in a few kidney punches here and there. So, Moreira just looked very sloppy in this fight and, you know, had Nyambar go through a little bit of a few rough patches, but he was still able to get the unanimous decision win to stay undefeated 11-0. But if he steps up to fight Gary Russell Jr., he'll basically get washed and washed fairly easily. But that seems like that's the only fight there available for Gary Russell Jr. because, hey, I'm not really seeing any of these guys at the featherweight division really stepping up to, you know, face him. I know that we talked about the thing there with Josh Warrington and Kid Galahad, where they're kind of like sitting up that matchup. And the WBO champ, Oscar Valdez, is, you know, pretty much on the other side of the six of the line. So that only leaves Leo Santa Cruz where, you know, after his particular fight, he's just going to just sit around there and straight up not fight Gary Russell Jr. So that's what we got, you know, out of that one. There was like one other, you know, semi-notable thing or semi-notable fight that took place at the Barclays Center that was fairly talked about in social media, but we don't necessarily have to touch on that. Because that might pinch a little nerve for a couple of people. So I want to, like, get into the fight card that was at the Toyota Center in Houston as you had Jaime Munguia defend the WBO super welterweight title against Takeshi Inoue in a fight that, you know, also, you know, kind of, like, exceeded some people's expectations. You did have, you know, Inoue, who was a much smaller fighter, be the, like, very gritty and be able to come forward to Jaime Munguia pretty much from round 1 to round 12. And, you know, a lot of people felt that he gave a better effort than the judges kind of gave him. And with it being in the Toyota Center there in Houston, Texas, they did have open scoring. And from those first six rounds, they gave Jaime Munguia every single round, and that was en route to, you know, a near shutout victory for Jaime Munguia over Takeshi Miura, as two of the judges gave him every single round, and one judge just gave him all but one round for him to retain that WBO super welterweight title. But he got caught a lot of times with the right hand of Inoue in this particular fight, and you know, he did say that he wanted to try to get a couple more fights there at 154 pounds before moving up. But if he even thinks about trying to unify against the guys that are currently out there with Jared Hurd and, you know, Tony Harrison eventually having his rematch with Jermell Charlo. He may have a whole lot of trouble trying to deal with any one of those guys. Matt, what do you think about the thing there with that?
I think the Munguia fight against Inouye, and I like Munguia too, but it kind of reminded me of when Miguel Cotto fought the Japanese kid on HBO in that card that nobody watched because another fight was going on that same day. And I remember talking to you about that fight, and even though Cotto won, I told you I was not impressed at all because he was just way too hittable. And if that guy had any ounce of power, he would have got Cotto the hell out of there. And that's pretty much what I saw yesterday with Munguia. I think any of the top guys, get him the hell out of there. You know, he's way too hittable. He literally blocks punches with his face. It's a nice, exciting style for the fans to look at, but it's a style that's going to lead to a short career, and it's a style that's going to lead to losses that you shouldn't have on your record. Can you imagine if this guy was getting hit like that against Jared Hurd? He'd have been done. If he was getting hit like that by Charlo, he would have been done. You know, lucky for him, he's in a weak division that's pretty much top-heavy. There's really no real up-and-coming contenders that's going to do any damage. But if he goes to middleweight like he's talking about, if they think they're going to match him with Canelo in some dream fight, that's barbecue chicken alert, baby. Like, come on, Jaime. Like, I'm not saying become Floyd Mayweather or Pernell Whitaker, but you got to have some type of defense, like just something. So what I saw last night was he did enough to win. I don't think the scorecards were that accurate about as it pertains to what happened, but I did think he won at least like 8-4 or 9-3. 121-108 obviously is ridiculous, but it's Texas. What are you going to do? Texas is known for having bad scorecards. Man, I like them. I do. Unification better not be in the future because these top guys are washing.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I kind of saw him, you know, have his left hand down pretty much the majority of the fight and just kept getting caught with those right hands by Inouye. And he didn't really do nothing much to, like, mix things up to try to finish off Inouye. Even though he, you know, was connecting a few times to the body, had a few, you know, left hand right, that kind of like buzzed Inouye, almost like put him down to the canvas, but it didn't, you know. My thing is that, you know, what this shows is kind of like what has been seen there in the past few fights from Munguia ever since he won that title from Saddam Ali, is that he is every bit as 22 years old as you could probably see out there. He hasn't really, you know, learned to mix up what he can do in the ring. He hasn't learned how to get his opponents in big trouble and try to finish them off, or, you know, try to use every bit of his foot frame to give smaller guys issues. So he has to learn that and, you know, pretty much try to learn that quick, especially if he's planning on trying to, you know, move up to the middleweight division later on down the line, because if he doesn't, he's going to have a, you know, big problem there with middleweight. And like you said, he wouldn't do much against those there at the 154-pound division or at the top of the 154-pound division that's there. Mike Grady, I want to hear our thoughts on, and then I'll go to Terrell next.
So I feel like I just heard Matt say that the style of using your face as defense won't last long and you might get a few losses on your record. Is that correct, Matt? Did you say that?
Listen, man, that's what I said. You know, that's what I said. I know there's a setup somewhere because you asked me that a little bit too calm. So let's just get to it.
I was just asking, man. That's all. Can I ask a question or something? So, I agree. You know, I agree with you, man. That style, like Provotnikov, like I imagine Provotnikov probably pissing blood still. You know, like that's why he ain't fighting no more, because of that style. Going back to Adam Kornacki. If he continues to fight like this.
I knew it. Yeah.
But no, I think Munguia, he's fortunate in that he has, I'm not going to call it the zone people, because I think it is Golden Boy plus Matchroom. And I think they do very well in protecting their assets that they feel gonna make money for them. Like, the scorecards were wide. I mean, you could say Munguia won. You could say possibly the other guy won, depending on what you want. You're gonna have to knock Munguia out if you're trying to win against him, because chances are Golden Boy gonna be the A side of the bout in most things. You know, they're gonna be the people, the ones who like get the refs and get all of these type of people and stuff, get all these officials. And if you ain't like Jacobs fighting Canelo, if Jacobs don't knock Canelo out, I mean, we preaching to the choir. Like, he ain't going to win unless you knock him out. That's for sure. But I think it was a fan-friendly fight. Munguia, you're right, probably won't do well against those other guys unless something changed. But didn't Canelo get hit in the face a lot early? Wasn't he, like, not as great at defense? And then at some point, like, you know, he started watching Floyd and then, you know, started really, really, like, honing in on using, like, the torso movement and stuff.
He went to the school of Mayweather. That's what happened.
He went to the school of Mayweather.
If you could break down Canelo's career right from before Mayweather and right when he fought the Mayweathers and the Lauras of the world, that basically jumped his development so much. But unfortunately, there's no Mayweather around for him to fight. Lara's with the PBC. I'm sure Lara will fight him. But you need someone in there, a veteran who has boxing, real boxing technical ability, that can teach this kid the ropes, because whatever they're teaching him is not working. Maybe he should hook up with the Reynosos. I don't know if they're going to do that since he's a potential Canelo opponent, but maybe Eddie Reynoso could do something with him.
And
yeah, I think
him being a potential opponent for Canelo, that's, man, that could be a long ways down the line, though, because, man, he is certainly not ready and won't be for a good while, like not for another 2 years plus.
But what will happen is they'll put Munguia against like a light, like something weird will happen, and then it'll be a light, an easy title holder or something. And then they'll give Munguia that belt, and then they'll feed it, like Matt said, he'll be food for Canelo. But it'll be a weak titleist. He'll possibly beat the weak titleist, and then they'll feed him to Canelo.
That's possible. That's possible. Just got to, you know, see how they're going to set up Munguia's career, because, initially it seemed like he was supposed to be the next in line, but, you know, right now going up against these, you know, guys that have a little bit more experience or, you know, are a lot tougher than he's not really being as impressive as, you know, maybe his handlers want him to be. So
they got to fix that up there a little bit. You know?
Got about like 5 minutes left in the live show. If y'all want to get in, you can call in 347-237-5539. That's 347-237-5539. Looking ahead, we got this rematch that's coming up February 2nd there for the WBO Light Heavyweight Championship. It's going to be over in Frisco, Texas. This Eleanor Alvarez versus Sergey Kovalev fight. You know, the first fight was a very good fight where, you know, they had Kovalev winning that fight up until the point where he got knocked out by Eleanor Alvarez. Now here we have him with all of the backstories that have been going down about, you know, what happened before the August fight. Now it seems like he may be a little bit more out of sorts than he originally was coming off that knockout going up against Eleanor Alvarez. So for me right now, I don't know if he's going to really get fully into this fight, and it might end up ending sooner than the first fight there with Alvarez. Coming up with the another knockout, and possibly that might be Kovalev's last fight that's going to happen out there.
What are they saying?
What are y'all looking for?
What is the stuff? What's the stuff they saying happened before the fight? What's the stuff are they saying that happened that's going to have him, his mindset going or whatever? What are they saying?
No, I think they're with Kovalev and the the issue there with the domestic violence or the assault that happened, what was that, in June of last year?
Oh, okay.
That came up, sometime last week. So that's going to be hovering around Kovalev leading on the day to this fight here against Eleanor Alvarez, where Alvarez on the flip side may have a clear head and just focusing on beating Sergey Kovalev once again.
Gotcha.
So you do have that. They do have Oscar Valdez in action, defending that WBO featherweight title against Carmine Thomasone. Another guy that's like undefeated. You're gonna have the IBF lightweight title on the line, vacated by Mike Garcia, as Richard Comey will go up against Ivan Chanayev, and Teofimo Lopez will be going up against Diego Magdaleno there for a minor lightweight title, where that could I wonder how that might turn out there. I mean, Magdaleno is, pretty veteran, but his last loss was a technical knockout to Terry Flanagan. So, trying to see there if they're trying to build up the profile of Teofimo Lopez even more. I think that Matt, you kind of like had Lopez kind of up there as far as like the prospect, a highly rated prospect last year, and he did get a few knockout of the year honors for what he did there at Madison Square Garden a few months ago. So that's what we have there lined up for top ranking main events coming together for this particular fight.
Well, it's a very good fight card. I think Alvarez versus Kovalev, I'm not going to lie to you. I think I'm going to take Kovalev in a rematch, as much as it pains me to say that. You touched on Kovalev's legal situation. For those who don't know, Kovalev is accused of punching a woman in the face, breaking her nose, slipping a disc in her neck. She had a horrible concussion, all because she didn't want to holler at him. It is what it is, man. You know, these thugs, that's the only thing I can say. He's a thug, you know. If this was any other fighter, a PBC fighter, God forbid, we saw what happened with Floyd Mayweather. We see what happened with Marcus Brown, who had his fight versus Sergey Kovalev canceled because of a violence against woman issue. You know, these things are very rarely swept under the rug, but for some reason it was swept under the rug for Sergey Kovalev. So honestly, I'm not gonna watch the fight. I'm not gonna watch his fight. I'm not gonna support it, because not because I'm some pious guy, but just I can't stand the double standard. Whatever you do, media, for one person, you gotta do it for everybody. Or it just looks like you're trying to hide something. And Kathy Duda should be ashamed of herself, you know? But it is what it is. As for my guy, Teofimo Lopez, my prospect of the year, I think Teofimo Lopez is already one of the two or three best fighters at 135 pounds. I just think he has to get the matchups to prove it. He's been calling out Lomachenko. We'll see if that fight gets done. He'll fight anybody. He doesn't care. He calls himself the Takeover. He said the Takeover is coming, and I think that that's exactly what is going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't – I don't know what it is, man, but it seems like it's a totally different thing that I expected coming from you, because, like, right after this particular fight, the whole thing was that Sergey Kovalev seemed like he was a broken fighter, coming after the losses that he had against R.J. Ward, and all he had to do was pretty much, you know, step up to him, and he'll eventually, you know, break apart because he doesn't have a plan B. If he can't walk right through you, then he doesn't have, like, any type of adjustment to, you know, finish up a fight. So that's kind of like what I see, you know, out of Sergey Kovalev, and all Alvarez has to do is just, you know, basically stand up to him, be able to take his best shot, and then keep coming at him and keep coming at him, and he'll eventually break. You know, we, you know, did have the instance where, you know, they were talking about, who was it, John David Jackson and Kovalev's chief second, you know, throwing Kovalev under the bus after the second Ward fight. And, you know, you kind of like seen, like I said, you seen what happened there in August of last year against Eleda Alvarez. So, I kind of like see a version of the same thing happening here in this fight, in this rematch, in that Alvarez is going to beat him again, and Kovalev is going to have He gonna go on Instagram and say that, hey, fans, I'm okay, I'm all good. And then a couple weeks later, you're gonna see him not want to be interested in fighting anymore. So that's what I see out of that.
I hope, Mike, so, because you know I can't stand Kovalev, but it's just something. It's something about this rematch that is bugging me. You know, I think Buddy McGirt, believe it or not, even though he's like a game loser trainer, I think he's going to have a decent enough effect on Kovalev that he's going to be able to pull off the victory. I think they're not even going to try to box. I think Kovalev is going to go balls to the wall, just come straight at this dude and try to get him out of there. Before, you had Kovalev trying to pull with the jab. Let me see if I can show that I have boxing skills. Listen, I think Kovalev knows the type of fighter he is by now. I can't go a full 12 rounds. So if I don't get these guys out of here, they're going to get me out of there. So I think Kovalev is really going to go hard and get this guy out of there.
So you see him taking more risks out there starting early in this fight.
I'm sorry, what did you say, JR?
Nah, you see Kovalev taking a little bit more risk earlier in this fight than
what he did in the first one. So.
Listen,
if he doesn't come out and take the necessary risk, he's going to get demolished. The guy cannot go 12 rounds. He can't go 12 hard rounds. He just can't. It's not in him. It's never been in him. Andre Ward exposed that. even Bernard Hopkins, to a certain extent, exposed that when they fought. How can't you get a 50-year-old man out of there? And you're supposed to be the crusher. You're supposed to kill the other division. I always say, when you're in there with someone that you're supposed to get out of there and you don't get them out of there, that's always a red flag to me, and that tells me everything I need to know about a fighter. So Kovalev needs to understand. I hope Buddy McGirt lets him understand, you better get this guy out of there or you're done.
Well, hopefully he pushed that into him leading up to this particular fight. Hey, Mike, what you got on this one?
I mean, I agree with what Matt's saying, is that in that Kovalev is a front runner, and he should probably approach this fight knowing that he is a front runner. But at the same time, they need to be prepared. If Kovalev is going to get him out of there, what they going to do then? Like, what's going to be the plan then? Because, you know, Kovalev wins most of his early rounds against most everybody. He start off real sharp. So if he start off, like, excited and just be out there trying to, like, knock him out, I feel like he's going to expel his energy just super faster. And it's I don't know. I'd be interested to see how the game plan is, though. Question, Buddy McGirt, is he really gay?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything about that.
Matt said somebody gay or something like that. He was joking, Matt. I'm sorry. I was just curious.
I'm sorry. What was
your
question?
I said, is Buddy McGirt really gay, or you just joking, like saying, like, being funny?
No, Buddy McGirt is his trainer.
Yes, what I'm saying, you said he was, is he gay, or are you just joking about that?
Oh, no. I didn't say gay. I said game.
Oh, game, okay.
Game.
It seems like every time a Buddy McGirt fighter is fighting, they get a lot of extra credit for being there, and even though they have no chance to win, they get beat up, but they seem to survive the fight, so people call them a game loser. Not gay. I said game.
Gotcha. My bad. I'm spreading rumors.
Yeah, I don't know who he's sleeping with. I don't know who the man's sleeping with.
My bad. I'm tripping. But, yeah, I think I'm interested to see the fight because I want to see what's next in terms of, like, Marcus Brown and where he actually fits in the division. So, I personally, you know, I honestly don't care whether Kovalev win or lose. Well, I think I would rather see Marcus Brown fight Kovalev to see how good he is and to see how good Marcus Brown would be compared to, say, like an Andre Ward or somebody like that. But, maybe he loses.
Marcus Brown might be a bad matchup for Kovalev right now, given the way that he was very active against Fatu Jack. I think, you know, with Kovalev being pretty much on the downturn of his career, him being less active, that might be not be a good matchup there for Kovalev. And I think that's something that I think they kind of like saw sometime there last year. So, you know, maybe they were reluctant to fight Brown in the first place. And that's why they ended up choosing Alvarez instead, and that plan just backfired on them. Terrell, what's your thoughts on Kovalev and Alvarez coming up next Saturday?
All the stuff that's happened to Kovalev over the past 4 or 5 years, I thought it's kind of pretty interesting that, Matt, you said that you probably would pick Kovalev to win this rematch against Alvarez. I think it's kind of curious on that. But just consider that, well, first, and before you go any further, I definitely respect the fact of how you stated that you don't even want to support the fight because basically when a man of color has a similar situation, whether it be domestic or something like that, DUI-related, and you gave great examples of where a man of color gets in trouble for something, it gets in the media, and from that point, their fight gets called off. And here's we got another person who obviously is not a man of color, and their fight goes on. even the fact that Coppola has made a statement, oh, you guys don't really know the full story yet, just wait for all the details to come out. Well, once again, like you alluded to, men of color have had similar situations and have been vilified in the media only until the truth comes out and everything. And even just to give an operating example, look at what happened to Chris Brown. Got accused of rape, and it turns out it's a total false accusation. And now his whole reputation is in question. But back to Alvarez of Coppola, or just focus on Coppola, for example. When you look back before Coppola fought Ward for the first time, he had the reputation of being the dominant fighter, that brute, unstoppable force. And to agree, he was that. And that's partly due to matchmaking, things like that. But nevertheless, he definitely had a period where he was the man out there in his division. But that's when he finally fought a true boxer, and with good enough power to earn the respect of Kovalev. And we know what Ward did to him in fight number one and also fight number two, right? And at that point, that in a sense took the mystique of Kovalev and took some shine off of it. He's not really a monster like we say he is. And when he fought Alvarez, Alvarez knocked him out. That knocked all the shine off of Kovalev from that point. So that mystique is definitely gone. And like you said, James, he's definitely on the downside of his career. And probably his best strategy is to go right in and try to go for the kill, if he can do that, because we know that Kovalev is not a true boxer like that. And it's like he can't just box his way to a decision for 12 rounds. We know that. And if you kind of just look back in history over some dominant figures, Roy Jones Jr. was dominant for a long stretch of time. But when he fought the likes of Glenn Jones, Tarver, stuff like that, that mystique slowly came off of him. And then to that point, he got reduced to what he is after his dominant period. Even Mike Tyson, to a degree, we already know he's a dominant force. And I'm not in no way suggesting that Kovalev was on the level of Roy Jones Jr. or Tyson. But despite that, he did have a period of dominance in that ground. But like with Tyson, we know all his story all too well. But once again, his outside stuff really came into the ring and derailed him and made him to what he was. I was just watching some clips of Tyson versus Lennox Lewis last week. And we know when those two fought, Tyson was not in his prime. He was still physically good, but just the mental issues, the stuff that he had been going through, that fight should have happened a few years earlier than what it did. And it definitely would have been a different result. But just Kovalev, his shyness off him, he's not the monster that we all thought he was for that small period. So I definitely got Alvarez winning this fight going away easily.
Yeah, I mean, those are examples there of, you know, Roy Jones and Mike Tyson, you know, not being, you know, as athletic or, you know, powerful as they once were going on later on in their careers. That kind of like broke away the aura that they had when they were at the top of their game. And here with Sergey Kovalev, you know, him being, like I said, the come forward and looking like an unstoppable juggernaut type of fighter, had basically been broken down by Andre Ward and kind of like finished off in that first fight there with Eleanor Alvarez. That I just don't see him being that same type of fighter there in the rematch. And, you know, with what Matt said about, you know, getting guys out of there, that Hopkins fight in 2014, yeah, with him not being able to, you know, get him out of there in 12 rounds, just, you know, showed that, you know, all you got to do is pretty much, you know, weather his first onslaught or first couple of onslaughts, and if you're able to catch him good a few times, then he'll eventually break down and you'll be able to finish him off there. So that's what I got out of that. But, you know, for me, I think that, you know, that'll eventually, you know, lead to, you know, if Kovalev does get the win, then it'll lead to a third fight. But if Alvarez ends up taking him out once again, then I see it being the end of Sergey Kovalev, and Alvarez can look for or towards trying to get a unification bout there somewhere. So that's what I kind of see out of that. That pretty much like covers most of everything here for this particular episode. Is there anything one of y'all wanted to add?
I heard you make a comment earlier today where you said you're going to skip it because you figure it's going to bring up emotions. I figure that you're talking about Deontay Wilder's brother losing his first bout by a knockout. I think that's what you're referring to. Am I correct?
Yeah, it seems like he got caught and was knocked out there in the first round. His fight in the undercard of the Thurman Lopez bout. So that was the thing there that, you know, I was going to, you know, possibly bring up. But I mean, a loss is a loss. You know, it's a still loss there for Marcellus Wilder to William Beat.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully
do you really hate Deontay Wilder that much that you are taking joy in a 29-year-old cruiserweight fighting in his fourth losing? It's not even as if his guy was up for a title shot. It's not like if anyone's saying he's a hot prospect. He is literally a guy who just took up boxing, trying to get into the game. And you wouldn't even know who this kid was if his last name wasn't Wilder. Like I said, I think you were there with Harold Brazil and the Brazil family when the Wilders put their hands on him. Because there is no reason why a four-fight cruiserweight should be getting any type of airtime on such a prestigious show like the Boxing Source Radio Show. I can't believe how far your hatred runs for this Wilder family.
Are you sure that this doesn't stem from Marcellus Wilder talking to, pretty much talking junk way back when you had Tony Bellew talking to Deontay Wilder and then Marcellus Wilder jumped in? You sure it isn't from that?
He was going to put the hands on him outside of the ring when anything goes. You know, if it's anything goes, my money's on Marcellus Wilder. That's what I'm going to say about that. Ask the Brazils.
I'm gonna ask Harold Brazil about that too, man. I haven't seen him around social media in a while, so I'm gonna see if I, you know, that would be a good little thing there to try to put on the Boxing Source Radio Show. Maybe I should contact Harold Brazil and put him on and see what I can, you know, basically get out of him. That might, you know, be a little bit of interest out there. You know, also had, fight there, like I said, with Gary Antoine Russell going up against Roberto Almazan there at the super lightweight. So Russell was able to get a two-round TKO victory there. It was pretty much an easy fight for him. So he goes up to 8-0. He's up-and-coming prospect there in the super lightweight division. So, you know, you have, you know, all of those guys there in the Russell family that are, you know, very successful there in boxing. So just keeping an eye on them there for that. So that's pretty much all I got here so far for this episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show. I want y'all to, you know, stay tuned for the next episode that's going to be coming there. First show in February 2019. Be on the lookout for that. We have the sister shows here, the Cohort Truth on Sports on the Golong Media Network and Take This Hell Football Talk Show. So be on the lookout for that. They may, you know, preview the upcoming Super Bowl that's going to be on Sunday. So we'll see how those things turn out. But until next time, folks, like I say, at the end of every show, the point of boxing is to hit, not get hit, not to stand and trade. On that note, I'm out. Have a good evening, everybody.
Yeah.